Presentations by Nicole Foss and Lawrence Bomert. Nicole is a big picture thinker in the areas of finance, energy, and the environment, and Lawrence is an inspiring and energetic community organizer from New Zealand. Together, they'll be talking about the smart, simple, and creative ways people are reinventing our world using tools like local currencies, collaborative consumption, green projects, and political organizing. Nicole Foss and Lawrence Bomert will be speaking at 7 p.m., October 9th, at the First Congregational Church, 4515 Southwest West Hills Road in Corvallis, and again at 7 p.m. on October 10th at Tabor Space, Southeast 55th and Belmont in Portland. More information can be found on the right-hand side of kboo.fm under Community Events.
Dada, dada, dada day, Thursday, Thursday, come one, come all to the Clinton Street Theater this Thursday for an evening of Dada film and music. We'll be playing surrealist silent films and cartoons, and the soundtrack will be provided by you, the audience. So bring your favorite musical instrument, kitchen implement, speak and spell, tantric bell, hotkeys, or tchotchkes to the Clinton Street Theater, Southeast Clinton and 26th Avenue in Portland, this Thursday, October 10th at 7 p.m. Tickets available at brownpapertickets.com. All proceeds benefit your community radio station, KBOO. Thursday, Dada, Clinton Dada, Street, KBOO. At least the Haggis arrived at a reasonable hour.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Japanese Garden, celebrating its 50th anniversary with the Wakaro Brothers, with Masahiro Nida, the three-stringed samurai, on the shamisen, Wednesday, October 16th, at the Portland Arts Museum's Grand Ballroom. Tickets and information at pam.spotlightboxoffice.com. And you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and also heard around the web at www.kboo.fm. Up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News... Coming up on the KBOO Evening News...
Activists gather outside the Supreme Court to protest against FCC regulations.
The governor is pressured to take a stand against fossil fuel exports.
Oregon's report on greenhouse gas emissions reduction is not on track.
Good evening. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 8th, 2013. I'm Nat Parker.
And I'm Diane Erickson. After almost a year, Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber has signed five bills that the state legislature approved after days of special sessions on Tuesday. Change to the public employees' retirement system for lower cost of living adjustments, raising taxes on some corporations and tobacco companies, and prohibiting local counties from regulating GMO crops are just three of the five bills that Governor Kitzhaber has put on the table to be passed. The governor has also promised relief for struggling schools and more cash in short term and lower pension costs in the long term. But the plans were met with a line of political critics urging lawmakers to vote no over the past months. Labor unions and environmental groups have been the most outspoken against the newly passed bills. Labor unions have said that changes to public employee retirement system, PERS, could illegally take away retirement benefits promised to workers, and environmental groups have stated that environmental issues have no place in agreements that were supposed to be about pensions and taxes. Kitzhoper says the bill measures will allow for increased spending on public education and lowering long-term retirement costs for state and local governments. Some of the laws the governor signed to go in effect immediately, while other bills will be in effect at the beginning of the 2014 year.
Pro-democracy advocates gathered outside the courthouse in the nation's capital while the Supreme Court heard arguments for and against limits on political campaign contributions. David Cobb, executive director of Move to Amend and proponent of a constitutional amendment to overturn the infamous 2010 decision, told KABU's Robin Ryan about planning the response if the court fines for McCutcheon.
I'm talking with David Cobb, the executive director for Move to Amend, and it is a busy day for advocates of democracy. Can you tell us what you're hearing about the rally outside the Supreme Court proceedings today?
Well, in a nutshell, the U.S. Supreme Court is zeroing in to dial yet another blow against democracy because they have heard oral argument in McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission, where they are considering stripping away some of the last flimsy remnants of campaign finance law in this country. And frankly, Robin, things don't look good because in the oral argument itself, Antonin Scalia literally said, as it related to campaign financing, that $3.5 million just didn't seem like a heck of a lot of money to him, showing just how completely and utterly out of touch the U.S. Supreme Court is in this time of austerity and crisis for the rest of America. But the most important thing from the Move to Amend perspective is that the grassroots response.
Can you talk at all about the status of the constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United?
Move to Amend is very clear that it is not merely a problem of campaign finance. The problem is that corporations are not merely exercising power, but they are ruling us. A small, wealthy elite has hijacked the social, political, economic, and legal institutions of this country, and the doctrine of corporate constitutional rights is a way to legitimize the theft. So corporations aren't exercising power, they're ruling us. We need a constitutional amendment that will not just get money out of elections, but will also overturn the illegitimate court-created doctrine that a corporation must be treated as if it's a person with inherent and alienable constitutional rights. That amendment is the We the People Amendment. It has been introduced into Congress. We encourage KABU listeners to contact your elected representatives, both U.S. Senate and U.S. Congress people at the House of Representatives, to support and endorse that effort, but even further, to make it a political issue going in to the upcoming state legislative races and even county commissioners and city council races. Pledge to amend. We need a campaign where we make the issue of corporate personhood a political question that we force all candidates for office, whether they're incumbents or challengers, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, Greens, Libertarians. Every candidate for office should be put on notice that we demand to know, do they believe corporations are persons with constitutional rights? Do you believe that money is political speech? Because we, the people, need to know before we cast our votes.
You're making a call for acts of civil disobedience. Talk about what forms you think they're inclined to take.
We put out a call asking who would be willing to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience if the Supreme Court does issue a ruling stripping away campaign finance laws. And in the course of several hours, we had over 1,000 people. And we are encouraging KABU listeners, if you are willing to get involved in any way, we need a pledge of resistance to prove to the ruling elite that they cannot continue, that we are going to actually resist.
How long do you expect it to take before the Supreme Court announces some kind of a decision with regard to this matter?
We would expect that that decision will come in January or February of next year, which is why we are gearing up and we want to be ready to help participate in rolling waves of social justice action all across the country, and we hope KBOO listeners will join us in that effort.
For more information about Move to Amend or David Cobb and the work that the organization does, visit www.movetoamend.org. For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
Ronald White is the Director of Regulatory Policy for the Center for Effective Government in Washington, D.C. He told KBOO's Don Merrill that many regulations on the books right now are suffering with the current government shutdown.
Well, it's really brought any movement on implementing regulations to a screeching halt. There are no regulations being developed at this point, and none certainly being issued or promulgated in the federal government. There is certainly a lot of concern that even some of the existing regulations that are on the books right now, for example, that protect our air, our water, and that relate to cleaning up hazardous waste sites that exist and that have been abandoned. All of those functions, for example, at the Environmental Protection Agency, for the most part, have come to a screeching halt.
You know, industries that are traditionally known to need the most environmental regulation, are they getting a pass essentially right now because there really isn't anybody to monitor them, or are there reports they don't have to fill out because there's no one to submit them to?
Well, they have reports to fill out. It's just that nobody's looking at the reports that they're filling out. And they certainly are getting a pass. I mean, EPA typically conducts, in 2011, they conducted about 19,000 inspections of polluting facilities, industrial facilities. That works out to about 365 inspections per week. So just in the more than 1 week that we've had a shutdown of the federal government, probably close to 400 inspections have not taken place in industrial facilities in terms of pollution emissions.
And we're not just talking about industrial facilities. I mean, we're talking about industries related to food services and all kinds of other things as well.
Well, that's true. The food situation is a little bit more complex because we have such a convoluted food safety regime here in the United States right now. So while one aspect of our food system is working, the other aspect that covers a different set of foods is not working in terms of protecting our health.
I was looking at your website, and you focus not only on regulatory compliance, but governmental transparency as well?
That's correct, yeah. That's the center is involved on trying to encourage a transparent government.
Now, what does that mean, especially in light of the shutdown right now? What does that mean?
Well, that means that in terms of availability of information, availability of data, that that the public has access to good information about what their government does, how it operates, what data it uses to develop its programs, so that the operations of government are transparent to the general public.
So you're not talking about a particular instance, like, for instance, when the September job numbers weren't able to be released because there was no one in the Bureau of Labor Statistics to release them?
Well, that's one example of where we've seen, unfortunately, a lack of transparency in terms of information. So certainly that would be one example. You know, we really are concerned more broadly about the ability of the public to have access to information about how government works and what it does and how it's what basis it's operating on for developing its programs.
How are you getting the word out to people about how they need to make government accountable and transparent right now when government is essentially closed to the American citizen?
Well, we're working, you know, we're communicating in a variety of ways. We're blogging. We put out a newsletter electronically that provides more in-depth information on some of these issues, disseminate information via Twitter. We also are involved with other organizations through a coalition called the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards, which the Center for Effective Government serves as co-chair of, along with Public Citizen.
I know there's an ideology that believes the less government regulation, the better. But do you think that people are not always aware of just how much government does to improve their quality of life?
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the messages that we're trying to get out at Center for Effective Government is just that government has an important role to play in providing health and safety, among other kinds of services, to the public. And the public sometimes doesn't really see that.
That was KABU's Don Merrill speaking to Ronald White, the director of the regulatory policy for the Center for Effective Government in Washington, D.C.
60 activists with the grassroots climate group Portland Rising Tide paid an uninvited visit to Governor Kitzhaber and the Oregon State Land Board in Salem this morning. They were there to put pressure on the governor to take a stronger stand against fossil fuel terminals in Oregon. Michael Gaskill interrupted the meeting to directly challenge Kitzhaber and the land board to deny any permits relating to coal, oil, and liquefied natural gas export terminals.
I'm here today, along with all these good people, inside and outside this building, to speak for thousands of Oregonians and tens of thousands more throughout the region. What we are here today to do is to ask you and the State Land Board to deny any and all permits pertaining to fossil fuel extraction and export. The DSL is considering, or will be considering in the near future, applications pertaining to the creation and or expansion of export terminals for coal, oil, and LNG. This is the most important issue of our time and is the most significant thing you could be dealing with today. And it's not even on the agenda. Our Northwest communities cannot afford the immediate health impacts along the railways, and our planet cannot withstand the continued ravages of fossil fuel extraction. So I'm here today, and we're here today, and tens of thousands of people around the Northwest are asking you right now to draw the line and join with your fellow Oregonians in publicly opposing any and all new fossil fuel export infrastructure and direct the DSL to find, and any other relevant agencies, to find that fossil fuel export projects are not in the highest and best interest of Oregonians, present and future.
Thank you very much. I'll just add a couple things because I am largely in agreement with your objectives here. Have made it very, very clear that I think this rush to make this country a coal exporting nation is unwise, particularly in the absence of any overarching national energy policy that suggests how this in any way would help move us towards a lower carbon future. I think the question really is the venue in which to exercise that concern. I can only speak for myself, not for the other members of the land board. There is a process that we are engaged in right now on the permitting side of that, and you're absolutely right, the DSL does have a role to play in that. It's not on the agenda today, but it will be on the agenda at the appropriate time. We can't, there's a process that's statutorily established, and we're moving through that process. We're not quite at that point in the process yet, and we do have to follow the established statutory process and then we'll obviously have to reach our own conclusions on the end of that.
With all due respect, sir, we've been going through the proper channels, and we've collected some of your wonderful quotes, but words aren't enough, and I think it's past time for action. The fact is that communities throughout the Northwest and around the world are leading right now, and we will be here when you are all ready to join us in this struggle.
Thank you very much.
Coal, oil, gas!
Though nearly 300 people from 18 states suffered salmonella poisoning from Foster Farms chicken processed in California, the company has yet to issue a recall. The United States Food and Drug Administration recalled staff investigators amidst a governmental shutdown to track the continuing outbreak. Foster Farms poultry products turned out to be at the center of another outbreak in July that sickened 137 people in 13 states. Two separate strains of salmonella from that outbreak demonstrated resistance to certain forms of antibiotics.
Paul M. Lewis starts his new job as the delegate to close Guantanamo Bay. Implemented during the Bush administration and war on terrorism, Guantanamo Bay currently holds 164 inmates, all of whom were captured after the September 11, 2001 attacks. The position Lewis holds was first announced in May of this year by President Obama in a major national security speech, but he first talked about closing Guantanamo in his 2008 campaign speech. Only about half of the detainees have been approved for transfer to different countries. The process has been slow because of concerns that prisoners will be mistreated or loosely monitored. 17 of the remaining prisoners have been on a month-long hunger strike. Closing the facility does not necessarily mean letting the prisoners go free, but can either mean transferring them to other countries or letting them go free. This position starts on November 1st.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. After this newscast, KABU's Linda Olsen Osterlund talks with Jen Davis about an upcoming event about anti-Monsanto and pro-bees, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes organizing guests from Not Enough as they talk about an upcoming queer music and arts festival. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Rock Radio speaks to Ramona Africa about the history of the new film, M-O-V-E. Tomorrow's weather? Patchy fog with a high of 62 degrees. Trust for America's Health released a report.
It is 5:22, time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Thomas Carlyle called economics the dismal science, but he was only half right. Dismal, yes, but a science, no. It's more like religions, where reality is shaped by belief or blind faith. And in the case of free market zealots, it can turn into a cult. Thus, we see them pointing these days to the dazzling light of the soaring stock market, proclaiming fervently that Wall Street's spectacular rise from the ashes of the Great Recession is proof from the god of Mammon that these are boom times. Lo, the magic of the marketplace is upon us. No, it's just the wizardry of the Fed. For 5 years, America's central bank regulators have been funneling two massive subsidies into Wall Street banks and giant corporations in an ungodly effort to keep them flush, while praying that they might use these government windfalls to create a job or two. The first subsidy essentially amounts to giving $85 billion every month to big banks. Yes, $85 billion. The idea is that this capital will then be channeled into investments that nourish our grassroots economy. In practice, however, bankers are putting it into gimmicky high-risk investment schemes that create nothing, into buyouts to expand their already too-big-to-fail empires, and into even heftier paychecks for themselves. The second subsidy is the Fed's relentless policy of artificially holding interest rates close to zero. This has severely punished middle-class retirees who count on getting interest incomes from their savings. But it has been a blessing from on high for huge corporations wanting to buy out their competitors or, in a totally unproductive bit of marketplace voodoo, to buy out themselves. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, the Fed's tinkle-down monetary policy has produced a truly dismal level of job creation and a hellishly wide chasm of inequality.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A recent report to the Oregon legislature from the Global Warming Commission says that the recession has helped Oregon reach their goals for 2010, but they are not looking good for 2020 or 2050. Forecasts show that the state is unlikely to meet the 2020 goal of reducing the greenhouse gas emissions to a level of 10% below the 1990 levels. Oregon plans to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to 75% of the 1990 levels by 2050. The report also states that future enactment of several energy policies will still leave the state short on meeting their goals. One of the key policies includes removing the sunset date from the state's clean fuel program, which aims to reduce the amounts of carbon in car and truck fuel. Environmentalists are expected to push for passage of the sunset bill in the February 2014 session. The report also states that even if all the suggested policies either remain in effect or are added, Oregon will still not meet the suggested improvements. The fact that Oregon met the reduction goals in 2008 to 2010 was due to the recession.
A man threatening to jump from the Vista Bridge last night was successfully talked down, according to Portland police. Police arrived at the scene late Monday to find the 36-year-old standing outside the 9-foot-tall anti-suicide fencing. Police say they convinced the man to climb back over the barrier, after which he was taken to the hospital. The city erected the temporary anti-suicide barriers in late summer of this year, following a petition by the group Friends of the Vista Bridge. The Vista Bridge has been the site of 19 suicides in the past decade, including 5 this year.
Protesters clashed with police yesterday in the cities of Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo, amid calls for increased pay for teachers and other public employees. The protests began peacefully Monday as up to 50,000 demonstrators marched through the downtown Rio de Janeiro. However, the protests later took a violent turn as masked demonstrators threw Molotov cocktails at public buildings, ransacked banks and ATMs, and smashed the gates to City Hall. Police responded with tear gas as a standoff developed. The demands for more public spending on health and education came amid ongoing protests against government austerity and a bloated budget for the 2014 Soccer World Cup. A related demonstration took place the same day in the western Brazilian state of Mato Grosso as striking teachers and postal workers stormed a soccer stadium. The $230 million stadium was being inspected by World Cup officials as the Brazilian government struggles to meet deadlines for the completion of stadiums and infrastructure ahead of the 2014 sporting mega event.
Up until recently, Fiji's dictatorship has made the South Pacific nation a target among world's democracies. But following the regime's pledge to hold parliamentary elections by September, Australia's recently elected Liberal government called for the reconciliation with the regime. After consulting two of the dictatorship's leading opponents, special reporter Michael Jean Horowitz was left wondering whether elections will in fact be held, and if the elections will be conducted, how fair they will be. Here's more.
Well, it's really brought any movement on implementing regulations to a screeching halt. There are no regulations being developed at this point, and none certainly being issued or promulgated in the federal government. There is certainly a lot of concern that even some of the existing regulations that are on the books right now, for example, that protect our air, our water, and that relate to cleaning up hazardous waste sites that exist and that have been abandoned. All of those functions, for example, at the Environmental Protection Agency, for the most part, have come to a screeching halt.
You know, industries that are traditionally known to need the most environmental regulation, are they getting a pass essentially right now because there really isn't anybody to monitor them, or are there reports they don't have to fill out because there's no one to submit them to?
Well, they have reports to fill out. It's just that nobody's looking at the reports that they're filling out. And they certainly are getting a pass. I mean, EPA typically conducts, in 2011, they conducted about 19,000 inspections of polluting facilities, industrial facilities. That works out to about 365 inspections per week. So just in the more than 1 week that we've had a shutdown of the federal government, probably close to 400 inspections have not taken place in industrial facilities in terms of pollution emissions.
And we're not just talking about industrial facilities. I mean, we're talking about industries related to food services and all kinds of other things as well.
Well, that's true. The food situation is a little bit more complex because we have such a convoluted food safety regime here in the United States right now. So while one aspect of our food system is working, the other aspect that covers a different set of foods is not working in terms of protecting our health.
I was looking at your website, and you focus not only on regulatory compliance, but governmental transparency as well?
That's correct, yeah. That's the center is involved on trying to encourage a transparent government.
Now, what does that mean, especially in light of the shutdown right now? What does that mean?
Well, that means that in terms of availability of information, availability of data that the public has access to good information about what their government does, how it operates, what data it uses to develop its programs, so that the operations of government are transparent to the general public.
So you're not talking about a particular instance, like, for instance, when the September job numbers weren't able to be released because there was no one in the Bureau of Labor Statistics to release them?
Well, that's one example of where we've seen, unfortunately, a lack of transparency in terms of information. So certainly that would be one example. You know, we really are concerned more broadly about the ability of the public to have access to information about how government works and what it does and how it's what basis it's operating on for developing its programs.
How are you getting the word out to people about how they need to make government accountable and transparent right now when government is essentially closed to the American citizen?
Well, we're working, you know, we're communicating in a variety of ways. We're blogging. We put out a newsletter electronically that provides more in-depth information on some of these issues, disseminated information via Twitter. We also are involved with other organizations through a coalition called the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards, which the Center for Effective Government serves as co-chair of, along with Public Citizen.
I know there's an ideology that believes the less government regulation, the better, but do you think that people are not always aware of just how much government does to improve their quality of life?
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the messages that we're trying to get out at Center for Effective Government is just that government has an important role to play in providing health and safety, among other kinds of services, to the public, and the public sometimes doesn't really see that.
We apologize. That was not the correct story about Fiji. Sorry for the mix-up, folks.
On Monday, the Trust for America's Health released a report stating that between 1999 and 2010, Oregon's drug overdose rates have doubled. Oregon ranks 21st among all of the states, and Washington, D.C. at 13 deaths per 100,000 people in the population. This now exceeds the amount of deaths related to motor vehicles. Oregon is attempting to fix this, though. They have taken 8 steps out of a 10-step program to combat prescription drug abuse. Oregon monitors their dispensing of controlled substances through the Oregon's Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, and a law that requires pharmacists to check the ID of patients. Oregon-licensed pharmacies must submit the prescription data they collect that involves controlled substances to the Oregon PDMP system. The system was created to help control the amount of controlled prescription drugs dispensed to help reduce the amount of drug overdoses in Oregon.
Occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, October 8, 2013. Palestinian Israeli negotiators meet without any progress announced, and Egyptian authorities open Rafah crossing with Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian and Israeli negotiators held an extended round of political talks under American mediation, yet again ending without achieving progress. Tzipi Livni and Chief Israeli Negotiator Yitzhak Malachu represented the Israeli side, while the Chief Palestinian Negotiator Dr. Saab Erekat and Mohammed Ishtaya represented the Palestinian side. While no progress was made on core issues, the two sides agreed to strengthen the American mediation role as demanded by the Palestinian side, yet U.S. Special Envoy to Israel-Palestinian peace talks, Martin Indyak, did not participate in the meetings. The two sides recently agreed to intensify negotiation sessions and to hold two sessions of direct talks per week to discuss a large area of issues in an attempt to reach a peace deal. Israeli TV Channel 10 quoted a Palestinian official speaking on conditions of immunity, stating that the two sides are holding excessive rounds of talks and decided to extend the number of hours in each round to 8. The official said that the United States has demanded Israel and the Palestinian Authority to intensify the talks, especially amidst rising serious conflicts regarding arrangements on the core issues such as borders, the refugees, and security. In other news, the Egyptian authorities announced on Tuesday that it will open the Rafah crossing until next Sunday. According to the deposed government in Gaza, the opening came after intense talks between the government and Egypt. The government announced that the students and patients will take advantage in crossing. Since Israel placed the Gaza Strip under total siege back in 2007, the Rafah crossing became the only way in or out of Gaza. In July of this year, when Egypt's army ousted the Muslim Brotherhood from the government, Rafah crossing was closed and only opened for a number of humanitarian cases and students with valid visas to other countries. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, October 8th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please keep visiting our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Nassam Banoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Rosalind Scott, Genevieve McDaniel, Robin Ryan, Don Merrill, and Sam Smith. The producer is Sequoia Wright. Special thanks to Michael Caskill. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO. What do you mean? I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Nat Parker.
Coming
up tomorrow on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Lisa Loving hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, hear Political Perspectives. With Lisa Loving, I think. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Anderson discusses how to convert a lawn or a weed patch to garden beds in about 2 easy steps. Now is the time to plant garlic and cover crops. Listen in to get tips on how to do both. The plant of the month is rootstock for grafting fruit trees. We'll have a new garden stumper, and we'll look at what's going on in the honeybee hive this month. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a member? Please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today to join. And stay tuned for Linda Olsen Osterlund from A Deeper Look, interviewing Jen Davis tonight about an anti-Monsanto event. Thanks, KBOO listeners.
Thanks, Nat.
Thanks, Diane. Good night.
Good evening, this is Linda Olsen Osterlund for KBOO News. And I'm going to bring you a guest today, Jen Davis of Bee Friendly Portland. We're going to be talking about the Bees and Seed Festival going on this weekend, part of a really a worldwide movement leading up to World Food Day, which is October 16th. Full disclosure, Jen Davis is a recently KBOO Foundation Board of Directors, but she's not here in that role today. She is here in her role of loving bees and being part of her own site, which is Bee Friendly Portland. Welcome to KBOO's airwaves, Jen.
Thank you for having me, Linda.
Well, I'm really glad to have you on today. So we want to talk about the Bee and Seeds Festival coming up this weekend that's really part of an international month of activities. I know you're not one of the organizers of the Bees and Seeds Festival, mm-hmm. but you are going to be a tabler there, and you're familiar with what's going to happen, so we're happy to turn to you.
Sure. It's going to be a fun event. It's a family-friendly event to celebrate farmers and producers and the healthy, local, organic, and pesticide-free food that sustains us and our pollinators, of course, because we can't eat without them.
And it's going to be taking place right here in inner city Portland by the Lloyd Center in the Holiday Park.
Right. And that's from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, October 12th.
Will there be bees there?
There certainly will be mason bees. I'll be sitting there at my table, Bee Friendly Portland's table, with my mason bees. I'll be teaching people that are interested how to take care of mason bees. A lot of people have questions about raising these native gentle pollinators in their yard, and I can help them out with that.
And so obviously the reason we care so much about bees is that they're essential to life on the planet as pollinators. I know that the activities taking place this weekend are also going to be talking about this is really non-GMO month. October is, and Vandana Shiva, famous for seed collecting and the resilience, believing in the resilience of indigenous populations to solve the problems of the earth if they're allowed to collect and protect their seeds, has been calling for a fortnight of action. Can you talk about this non-GMO month and how it directly applies to what's been happening here in Oregon?
Sure. As people have been following recent events, there have been a coalition of industrial agribusinesses combined with ALEC and the Koch brothers who slipped some legislation into our recent bills. The Senate Bill 863, it was formerly called Senate Bill 633, was recently passed. It's a seed preemption bill, and what it does is strip local control of decisions on seeds and agricultural production.
So by stripping local control, what does that mean?
Well, an example is in the Willamette Valley, we have $15 million industry of organic and specialty seed producers. And the Willamette Valley is described by the Friends of Family Farmers organization as one of the few places left in the world where we can grow seed without genetic contamination. Unfortunately, the $500 million grass seed industry is wanting to bring in a rotation crop that would be lucrative for them of rapeseed canola. Unfortunately, this canola can be used for biodiesel, and so they feel that it will be lucrative for them, but it also, 90% of the canola in the country is genetically modified. The chance of it being genetically modified is quite high, and canola is a very promiscuous plant. It can genetically transfer its genetic material to other plants such as broccoli and kale and other brassicas very easily, and so effectively that would make it very difficult, if not impossible, to grow true organic seed in the Willamette Valley of these crops, and could be really decimating for the farmers there.
It would be both detrimental to our farmers who grow organic seeds, but it seems like it would be also detrimental to the world as a whole as we get an increasing decrease in the amount of indigenous seeds that are being protected. Monsanto is pretty aggressive around the world, and we found that we had some in our wheat that affected our ability to export.
We've seen here in the United States that 80 to 90% of the sugar beet is now genetically modified. Roughly 90% of all the corn is genetically modified. It's like 80 to 90% of the soy is genetically modified. And so if you're eating non-organic foods, even if you're just eating dairy and meat, if those animals have consumed genetically modified corn and soy, you're also eating genetically modified corn and soy on a regular basis. And unfortunately, there have been no long-term human safety tests done on these crops. So we have seen a tremendous rise in allergies in children since the introduction of genetically engineered crops, and currently the United States has the highest rate of cancer in the world. So we have to seriously look at what we're doing here with the genetically modified crops and whether they're really right for agriculture, or, you know.
You know, we have our neighbors to the north in Washington State are also in a battle right now over genetically modified foods. In their case, it is a label bill, a label initiative that they're trying to get passed that would require products that are carrying GM ingredients to put it on the label. That's Initiative 522. And there's been a lot of money brought in to advertise against it. I've seen some pretty effective sounding ads where they have people who grow non-GMO food saying this bill is going too far. Will there be any people at the event on Saturday talking about or representing the movement going on in Washington State?
There certainly will be people that are talking about that issue. There's a diverse group of businesses and organizations that are sponsoring this, including the Center for Food Safety, Food and Water Watch, the Organic Seed Alliance, Create Plenty, Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides, and so on.
And so all coming together for an all-day festival. Now, I understand there's also been announced that there will be a march against Monsanto, possibly coming out of that day's festivals. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, the organizers, I've spoke with the organizers, and they said that there's not a particularly planned march against Monsanto, but they expect one to, quote-unquote, erupt. So there could very likely be a march against Monsanto, and there will be a lot of fun things happening at the event. There'll be music, educational activities, kids activities. There'll be vending of fruits and flowers and vegetables and grains and beans, and folks are encouraged to bring non-GMO cans of food for the Oregon food break, for the food drive for the Sunshine Division, and to bring a picnic to enjoy the event.
And to bring reusable utensils, et cetera.
Absolutely.
Because they won't be being provided there. Now, World Food Day is coming up. That's October 16th. That's an initiative of the United Nations. Can you say anything about that?
Well, World Food Day is important. It's important to recognize that 70% of the world depend on small family farms and community-based agriculture. And the whole idea of World Food Day is to counter the assertions that we need genetically modified crops and industrialized food systems to feed the world. This is not true. And in fact, we are seeing around the world genetically modified crops are failing, and they're having to use more and more pesticides and herbicides to try to grow these crops. So this is all about supporting local agriculture.
Well, in terms of the World Food Day activities that are going on, I believe that the G20 had a meeting last summer or fall, about 8 months ago, where they turned over the business of food aid to the large agricultural companies like Monsanto. Are you familiar with that?
Well, I'm somewhat familiar with that. It certainly is a travesty that we're seeing our food security and food sovereignty in this nation and around the world is being jeopardized by the control of these corporations that are coming in. I mean, we're seeing over there in Europe right now, they've recently banned the neonicotinoid pesticides, which are being used to pre-treat GMO crops, because the GMO crops are failing, even though they have a bred-in pesticide to try to kill the corn rootworm, for example, that's failing. The rootworm has evolved past that. So now they're pre-treating millions of acres of genetically modified seeds with a very bee-toxic pesticide known as neonicotinoid pesticides. And the European Union saw such a huge decrease in their bees, just like we've seen here in this country, that they banned this pesticide. And companies like Syngenta and Bayer are now suing the European Union so that they can get that pesticide right back into their crops and on the market. So extremely powerful organizations that we're up against.
And that's one of the reasons why we're calling on people to, or you're calling on people to come to the Bees and Seeds Festival. I want to reiterate that that's Saturday, October 12th, this coming Saturday. It's at the Holiday City Park, which is right there next to Lloyd Center on 11th and Holiday Street. So, and it's 10 to 2 family-friendly activities. With regard to sustainable food production, talk about these neonicotinoids, and they are the kind of pesticide that was behind the big bee die-off we had this summer. Is that correct?
Increasingly, scientists are pointing to this pesticide, along with other fungicides and herbicides that are being used, as really probably the central reason for colony collapse disorder. Right now, my organization, Bee Friendly Portland, has been working trying to get the neonicotinoid pesticides out of our nurseries, because this is a systemic pesticide that was invented so that it could be taken, so that it would, it's water soluble, it's actually absorbed vascularly by the plant and then expressed in pollen and nectar. So it makes the entire plant very toxic for bees, and then they end up taking this toxic pollen and nectar back to their hives and feeding this to their larvae. It acts like a neurotoxin on the bee. They're not able to, it damages their ability to navigate, to remember where forage is, and to learn new tasks. And so it is having tremendous impact on bees' ability to take care of themselves and to survive. And right here in Portland, we lost 42% of our managed honeybee colony last year. And
wow, that's significant. Say that again, Jen.
Yeah, last year we lost 42% of our managed honeybees here in Portland. And in the country, we're seeing, on average, at least a third every year of our honeybees lost. And this neonicotinoid pesticide is, unfortunately, the most commonly used pesticide now in the world. And you can walk into pretty much any major garden center here in downtown and buy these neonicotinoid pesticides. So we just recently did an event celebrating Garden Fever Nursery on 24th and Fremont, because they got rid of their neonicotinoid pesticide. And we're going to be saluting some other nurseries as well and urging people to support those nurseries that are taking the bold step to no longer carry these extremely toxic products for bees. These are the same pesticides that killed those 50,000 bumblebees in Wilsonville, Oregon, the same class of pesticides.
And so to find out more about this issue, the issue of the neonicotinoids, the issue of Senate Bill 863 that was slipped through in a special session without a chance for the public to weigh in on it, and find out what kinds of actions and activities are planned to stop that going forward, and to learn about World Food Day and just have a fun day out with your friends, family, and kids. So once again, that's going to be the Bees and Seeds Festival. We're happy to bring you the news of that here at KBOO. And I want to thank you, Jen Davis, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And this has been Linda Olson-Osterlund for the KBOO News, bringing you a special report on an activity going on this weekend. It's the Bees and Seeds Festival at Holiday City Park on Saturday, 10 to 2.
KBOO's Fall Membership Drive starts on the 10th, and you could help make reaching our fundraising goal a little easier by offering a matching donation of at least $500 for us to use on air during the drive. Matching money is a really great motivator to entice our non-contributing listeners to donate, so please email membership@kboo.org if you would like to sign up or have any questions. Or just call 503-231-8032 and ask for the membership department to plan your fall drive matching gift today.
Wednesdays in Portland are a little more festive these days, thanks to Creative Collaborations and Hump Day PDX. Hump Day PDX is a street festival in Southeast Portland, featuring the live music and art exhibits of creative entrepreneurs who are living on the streets. There are also family activities to enjoy, food to eat, and a beer garden for drink, all organized by Creative Collaborations in support of struggling artists and in an effort to stimulate the local neighborhood economy. The next Hump Day PDX is October 9th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Southeast 9th and Belmont in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
Yeah.